Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion on Australian rules football on the occasion of the republication or the latest version of Australia's Game. Stories, essays, verse and drama inspired by the great Australian game of football, edited by Ross Fitzgerald and Ken Spillman. So we have two speakers and a budding poet here tonight. Our speakers are going to be Peter Corris and Barry Oakley, and Ross Fitzgerald's going to read a poem which he wrote himself. It's on the Collingwood Football Club, but who else would write? So I'll introduce our speakers very briefly, because they're all well known. Peter Corris, an Essendon tragic, is a PhD. He's a journalist, he's a writer, but I guess he's best known for his 38 detective stories on the Cliff Hardy series and a book on Fred Hollows, a biography on Fred Hollows, followed by Barry Oakley. I first saw Barry's play The Feet of Daniel Mannix in Melbourne a long time ago with Anne. It was a long time ago. There's been a very important play. He also did The Salute to the Great McCarthy. He's worked on The Australian. He's written in numerous places. So he's a writer of fiction and non-fiction, and he's recently done his memoir. So Barry Oakley, who's a Melbourne tragic, will follow. And Ross Fitzgerald, who's the author of 1,347 books. Although when he's modest, he only puts it down as 36. Or is it 38?
That's Jared Shane.
And Ross is going to read a poem that he wrote and for which he holds full responsibility. So we'll lead off with Peter Corris, then we'll go to Barry Oakley, then Ross will read his poem, then we'll have questions and discussion. Let's kick off with Peter. Many thanks, Peter. And the general topic is the Australia's game, football as art and culture. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you. Thank you, Jared. Yes, I've written 38 books about a private detective named Cliff Hardy. 39. I'll get a plug in right away. 39 comes out in January. And I've half the way through number 40. I'd like to be able to tell you that Cliff Hardy is a passionate advocate of Australian football and an ardent supporter of Essendon, but I can't do that. When I came to Sydney to write the Hardy private detective novels, I knew that they had to have Sydney and New South Wales flavour, and this was well before the Sydney Swans got here. And so I had a friend of mine take me to rugby games so that I could learn something about this code and maybe infuse the books with that. And I was appalled by what I saw. And so I've never been able to tout Cliff as an AFL fan. But over the years, I've managed, I think, to infiltrate, to do a little bit of subversive work. From time to time, Cliff has noticed four goalposts springing up on football grounds and makes a wry remark about them. And in the book I'm just finishing, there's a former boxer who gets a job when he's finished fighting as a fitness coach with the Sydney Swans, which... One of the hard guys describes as a sissy game, although he doesn't use the word sissy, and I don't think I have to use the word, you can imagine the word. And Hardy remains sort of more or less supportive of the notion that AFL is a genuine game. I cannot abide rugby, and as for soccer, I'm reminded of doing a series of interviews with Bill Hunter, the late Bill Hunter, whom you'll remember as a great actor. That's another story. We were supposed to do a biography and an autobiography together, and it never happened because once I'd written the draft and Bill read it, he realised that most of what he told me wasn't true. Anyway, Bill was an ardent Essendon supporter, played for Ballarat in the Central Victorian League, and played against the original plugger, Tony Lockett's father. So he had good AFL credentials. And he went to a few soccer games, and he said that the game itself was as boring as batshit, but the atmosphere was great. And I must say that when I saw Jerry Marsden singing "You'll Never Walk Alone" at Wembley with about 100,000 Liverpool supporters, I was moved. But I've known one person who converted from gridiron American football to Australian football and became a passionate Carlton supporter, I think, and would roar in his American accent, "Foul!" And I've known several people who converted from rugby to Australian football. But I have never, ever, and you could put this on my tombstone, which sometimes I feel is probably in the process of being carved now, at age 71, with a heart bypass, 56 years of diabetes. Never mind. Have I got your sympathy as well?
We've got an ambulance outside.
I have never known anyone to convert from Australian football to any other code. I'm delighted to be in the company of the people I'm with, the men and women in this book, and to feel in these sort of divisive, difficult times, solidarity on one thing at least. Thank you very much.
So we go with Barry. Peter's essay is called "Barracking for the Bombers," and now we go with Barry Oakley.
Thank you.
Whose chapter is called "McCarthy's Taboo." Barry.
Yeah, but that's not. I won't inflict that on you. This is related to that, but not directly lifted off that. Now, I've got 5 handwritten pages. I want to warn you.
That's fine.
That's 15. I timed it. It's 15.
Yep,
15
fine.
Bit. All right. It's called "A Birth and a Death." Australian football began in the late 1850s in the parkland between the Melbourne and Richmond cricket grounds. Football was becoming popular at the time in English private schools. There was Eton football, Harrow football, and rugby football. Some preferred handling and passing the ball, others kicking. These variants came out to Melbourne in the gold rushes. When young men tried to get fit between cricket seasons, some went for passings, others kicking, and the odd Irishman typically jumped up and caught the ball. So, in the beginning, Australian rules had no rules. A game consisted of packs of players in tucked-in trousers and bright caps, tackling, pushing, dodging and kicking. The fact that this unruly activity wasn't allowed in either the Melbourne or Richmond cricket grounds turned out to be valuable. There was more space in the parkland, and this spaciousness is still a feature of the code. It soon became obvious that some rules were needed. a committee was formed, and in 1858 they were drawn up. But not many. They took up no more than a single page. Gradually, what started as a rough-and-tumble contest between gentlemen spread down to the lower orders, and by the 1870s, there was a fully-fledged competition. At the top, in the class sense, was Melbourne, and at the bottom, just across the park, was largely working-class Richmond. And there was room in all these open spaces for men to take a running jump at the ball, but it took a while to catch on. By the 1880s, the more daring players were jumping higher and higher, led by Charles Commotion Pearson of Essendon. Quote, "At East Melbourne Ground on Saturday," wrote the Argus, "Mr. Pearson gave spectators many thrilling moments with his phenomenal leaps skyward. Ladies in the pavilion screamed for fear Mr. Pearson would cause himself serious injury. Who knows but that this way might be a revolution in high marking. Perhaps in years to come we will see players all over the field sailing into the air in this fashion." This is the Argus fellow still writing. What a thrill the game would become if all players tried out this new idea. And what a thrill the game did become. By the end of the 19th century, crowds numbered thousands, and a passion for Australian football spread like a benign virus through the city of Melbourne. By the 1940s, high jump, a few generations, when I was a small boy, I succumbed to the miasma. "Who do you barrack for?" was always the introductory question. It was the Melbourne boys' equivalent of a dog sniffing at the hindquarters of another. It gave you an identity. It coloured you internally as well as externally. A Richmond supporter's yellow and black, or a Melbourne supporter's red and blue, were qualitatively different. They were tribal markings. It was my misfortune to be taken by kindly neighbours to watch Melbourne matches, which they invariably, at least in those days, won. There, safe in the genteel members' stand, support for the Demons sank into my being, leaving a red and blue stain that neither age nor intelligence would expunge. Melbourne Football Club supporters would barrack, but not, since we were middle class, it would be done respectably, unlike the lower orders across in the outer, who would do so raucously, because they, Collingwood, Footscray, Richmond, were working class and you know better. Melbourne supporters would only rarely be roused from their tartan rug and thermos of tea respectability, unless the team won a premiership, which they did often. I can remember them abandoning all restraint and turning into a howling mob only once, and that was Jack Dyer's doing. Dyer was Richmond's hard man, adept at the shirt front and elbows, for which he'd earned the nickname Captain Blood. One Saturday in the late 1940s, Melbourne were playing Richmond at home, and halfway through the second quarter, they were well in front. In desperation, the Richmond coach summoned Captain Blood from the back line. Something had to be done, and Jack Dyer did it. As he lumbered towards the Melbourne forward line, he dealt a tremendous hip and shoulder behind play to an inoffensive Melbourne ruckman called Frank Hanna. Hanna didn't just fall, he collapsed and lay apparently lifeless on the turf. There was a moment's stunned silence, then tumultuous roaring and booing, as Hanna, his collarbone broken, unconscious, maybe dead, was stretched from the field. It simmered down until half-time when the players came off for a break. Then, as Dyer approached the race, with a policeman on either side, it rose again. Even as he walked into that tsunami of loathing, he was calm and seemed to give off a quiet satisfaction, as if Richmond's plebeian underdogness had been redeemed. By then, Dyer had bandages on both knees and was close to retirement. He had an unusual build, skinny white legs and narrow hips, which made the breadth of his shoulders even more marked. He had lost his speed and he couldn't turn, so he simply ran through a player or a pack. Norman Smith, then a Melbourne forward, and later to become the greatest of all coaches, once described what happened if you got in Dyer's way. Quote, "There was a floating sensation of unreality as I crashed headfirst into the turf. A yellow light flashed across my eyes. No human could hit that hard. But then I often wondered if Jack Dyer was human." Many speculated about that. At 35, after 312 games, he hung up his number 17 black and yellow Guernsey. He went into radio, and then when TV arrived in the late 50s, he became one of the first player celebrities in a show called World of Sport. Now the jug ears and concrete chin could be seen in close-up. It was an archetypal proletarian face, one that Elbert Tucker could have created. Fellow champions, Lou Richard and Bob Davis, did most of the jokes, while Dyer's humour, like his old football opponents, was generally unconscious. Good, good.
That's a good line.
Thank you. I was waiting for that. He malapropped, he spooted, he gaffed as his shirt fronted his way through the English language. Fitzroy, he once claimed, had copulated to the opposition. And then describing a Hawthorn game, he's tackled strongly by tack. Later, Mark Lees, a ruckman, his long arms reaching up like giant testicles. Of an overweight player not doing his best, quote, "He spent too much time on the French Riverina." Every week, Dyer fought running battles with difficult surnames, especially Italian ones. His attempts at Robert Dippia Domenico were a delight. Dopper Didico, Dipper Dottolio, old black Dipper. Mathematics too could be a problem. They've got a couple of good players in Harvey, dot, dot, dot. Chris Danaher, he's got three brothers who were both played for Essendon. Eventually the stories and the solecisms run out and Dyer returned to private life. When we ourselves moved to Richmond while still barracking for Melbourne, one of our children saw him labouring up Richmond Hill, stooped and frail, heading for St Ignatius, the great Gothic pile that sits at the top of it, where Dyer had once served as an altar boy. On August the 23rd, 2003, at 89, Jack Dyer made his final trip to the top of the hill to his own Requiem Mass. The church was packed and the sacred and the secular melded. Richmond players formed a guard of honour as the club song rang out over the loudspeakers. Later, at the Punt Road Oval, mourners gathered around an image of his number 17 Guernsey painted on the grass, and 312 yellow and black balloons were released, one for each game he'd played. 25 years earlier, in September 74, when we'd moved to Richmond and brought claret and corduroy trousers to a beer and blue singlet territory, we were the first to gentrify Richmond. I walked up to St Ignatius around 5 o'clock one Saturday afternoon to see what would happen if Richmond beat North Melbourne in the grand final, which was nearing its climax at the MCG a kilometre away below me. There was a sudden erupting roar. It was taken up by car horns, and in the narrow streets on the slopes, people came out of their houses cheering and shaking hands. Father Flynn, the parish priest, rushed to the ropes like Quasimodo under the great spire, and the bells pealed out over the city. The Tigers, by the grace of God, were premiers. I knew then that Richmond was tribal in a way Melbourne, my team, could never be. And a quarter of a century after that premiership triumph, its presiding deity had gone, assumed into the firmament in a cloud of liniment and clichés. A deprived suburb had been redeemed. Winning, Dyer had shown, was possible, and the gap across the parkland between Melbourne and Richmond clubs, where the game first began, could be closed. Jack was not immortal, but some of his solecisms deserved to be. I'll finish with a couple. In one of the many on-camera arguments he had with Lou Richards, Lou put a question to him that Jack was unable to answer. "Who do you think I am?" Jack retorted. Norman Einstein? On another occasion, the two pundits were discussing a player whose nickname was Duck. "He was called Duck," said Lou, "because of his gait." "Nothing of the sort," snorted Dyer. "It was the way he walked." Thank you.
Many thanks, Barry. It's just as well Mr. Dyer's dead, I think. Ross is going to move us all with his poem. Ross.
Oh, man.
Ross. And Ross's poem is in the book, in his chapter.
Thanks, Brian.
It's an absolute pleasure, Ross.
Never believe what he says. For those that... I imagine there are some people here who don't know anything about Aussie rules football. Collingwood are the Magpies, and our colours are black and white, and we're often known as the Mighty Woodsmen. And my piece in the book is about my father, called Never Forget Where You've Come From. And it starts off by saying, my father, Bill, wasn't a liar, so it must have been me. For years, I thought that he played for Collingwood first. But when I researched the book, I found that he'd played over 100 games for Collingwood seconds and never got a game in the first. And this was at a time when Collingwood won 4 premierships in a row in the late 1920s. And that's never, ever been rivalled. So in the piece that I wrote about my dad, I included a poem that I wrote for him shortly before he died. And it's called Father as Hero. "It is not shame this night, my father. We have passed beyond all that. I hold you, brave magpie, comforting the wild horses of my asthma nights. Proud, clumsy, gentle man. The dark won't hurt me now. No need to turn on the lights or bring Snowy near. Yet where do the fish sleep, Daddy? I'm in the team, my follower. Oh, to see you soar in the ruck for Collingwood. Both knees bandaged, no teeth at all. Where I come from, Professor, we like to see things in black and white. I've seen you cry, old warrior, of my brother Roddy's death, the brightest star in all the skies. Yet what does his gravestone say? The dignity of your despair, my father, how your silence thundered. No tears are needed now. Still, I ask, was it all meant? So much shame and hate and dark denying. I'm beginning to define my needs from my wants. The hours before midnight are the best. I am my own man now, old friend. I haven't forgotten where I came from. Do the fish sleep still, my father, in such seas that ask neither condition nor recompense? Love's best sleep is sweet. Be blessed then, and range well, big woodsman. There are many fields in which to reap." Thank you.
Ross's chapter is called Never Forget Where You Came From, and that's his chapter, and the poem is in the chapter. Many thanks, Ross. The poem is quite controversial in the office here. Some of the staff read it and wept.
You thrive.
Others read it and headed for the bin.
It was the latter.
But it did...
We do have Philistines.
It did have an impact. So we come to question discussion. We have 3 speakers, all of whom I'm sure would be happy to answer any questions about the great game. And as I said before, I haven't said it yet. Yeah, Janet Grundy has copies of the book I mentioned before, Australia's Game, Stories, Essays, Verse and Drama, inspired by the Australian game of football, edited by Ross Fitzgerald and Ken Spillman. And there are about 35 contributors here, including...
No, 50 contributors, $35.
Okay, yeah.
Name a few.
But we're doing a special deal here tonight. We'll give you 35 contributors for $55 as a way. Manning Clark's here, Bob Santa Maria's here.
Don Watson,
Ramona Cavell's in it, and... Terry Lane, Bruce Mark Law. O'Connor, Bruce Doole, the Carlton footballer. Well, I mean, he might be in the next edition. So there you go. They're all there. I mean, I think I'm the only one who's not here, Ross.
Now, why would that be?
I wasn't asked.
Paul
okay.
The singer or the...
Yes, Paul Kelly the singer.
Paul Kelly the singer, yes. Not the other one. No. Jeffrey Blaney's in it. So everyone's in it. Well,
Stuart McIntyre.
Stuart dead? No. Okay, so Anne's got a microphone.
You have to have this.
And you've got to talk into the microphone, and we're ready to go. Can I just ask Peter? I mean, I think we were discussing before John Coleman, and I think you saw...
Yes.
John Coleman play. So it was a long time ago. It was in a previous century. Don't tell anyone which one. But tell us about John Coleman, who was, I suppose, the great star of Essendon then, and to some extent still. So, yes. Peter, if you come up here and stay here,
yeah.
And then we'll get the others up in time too.
Okay.
So you're going to tell us about John Coleman. Okay.
Yeah, Coleman is iconic. He was one of a string of full forwards playing who could take very high leaps over packs, sometimes riding other players as he ascended, and catch the ball, which is not an easy thing to do. And it's not that well done these days. And then kick the very flat punt they used to kick in those days. And Coleman kicked over 100 goals quite a few times. He was recruited from down near Hastings, down near the Mornington Peninsula. And you can see why he would have been recruited, because I think in 1 year playing country football, he kicks like something like 160 goals. And so in modern day parlance, he would have been the number one draft pick. I did see him play a couple of times, kicking 10 goals. He regularly kicked 9 and 10 goals. He was a charismatic creature, and apparently he can read about him in the Australian Dictionary of Biography. The Professor of History at Melbourne, Graham Davison, wrote the entry on John Coleman, and it's well worth reading. Because he was a remarkable player, and then he coached Essendon to a couple of premierships, and like iconic Australian heroes Russell Mockridge, Heck Hogan, John Marshall, people like this, he died young. I mean, if you're going to stamp yourself as an iconic figure, like many we can think of, Alexander the Great. Jesus Christ. Play well and die young. And we have the John Coleman Medal for the leading goal kicker in the AFL today.
Hang on, stop. And I want you to stay there and just move a little bit to your left.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Ross,
that's my right.
Sorry.
Yes. I just want to follow. If I can just follow on from Peter.
You see, he doesn't like people moving to the left.
No.
I couldn't resist.
Some of you may know that Hawthorne's great full forward was a bloke called Peter Hudson. This is a true story. But he played for Hawthorne. And there was a Presbyterian church in Hawthorne that had the question, what would you do if Jesus came to Hawthorne? And someone had written under, I'd move Peter Hudson to set half forward. That's a true story.
It's one of the great AFL stories.
And while I'm here and Peter was talking about the gay possibilities, one of the great lines in this book is a true story from a councillor from Mordialloc called Basil Fitchley, who said, he wrote and also said, "Not enough football turns boys into pansies." I think that's funny, don't you?
Hang on, I want you to stay there. And I want you to stay here, and then we're going to get Barry up. So, Barry? Barry's got another recycle.
We can all hold each other up. Barry, don't drop the bag out.
The three wise monkeys, like Lou Richards.
Brave champion's going to ask a question.
Thank you, Barry.
All six footers.
Yeah. I want to tell you about another full forward called Pratt.
I remember Bob Pratt. I don't really remember him.
It's a legendary picture where he's standing full stretch on top of a man who's standing full stretch upright.
Right.
And a student in a Melbourne University college said to a friend, "There's a picture of my dad." And it was Pratt taking a mark.
Right.
And the guy said, "Your name's not Pratt." He said, "No, my dad's the guy he's standing on."
That's a good one.
So, Barry, tell us about Bob Pratt.
I'm not so old to be able to do that. I take that.
Well, you read about it. He played for South Melbourne.
No, I saw his photos in the paper.
Well, there you go.
And he kicked 150 goals.
He did kick 150 goals.
Which is still the record.
Yes, it's still the record.
Tied by Peter
Hudson.
Yes,
that's right. And you probably know, the song Up There Kazali. Mm-hmm. Well, that was based upon the Swans full forward Roy Kazali.
Right.
And he said, "The only thing I feared in my life was the monstrous regiment of Collingwood women with their umbrellas."
Right.
And he was most famous
for being... He wasn't a full forward.
Kazali.
Kazali was a ruckman.
Was he?
He was a ruckman. But he jumped.
He learned it here. And I think Pratt was best known for being knocked down by a truck before the grand final, wasn't he? Driven by a Collingwood driver paid by John Wren.
Yeah.
None of which is true, but it's a great story. It's almost as good as the Peter Hudson one. Now, who's next? Who is next? Can I? Here we go.
Just three gentlemen. Have you been surprised at the nationalisation of the game in such a sort of fairly rapid time, in 20 to 30 years, that Sydney, although it did have a little bit of a roots. Right. Well, my kids were in a junior football club that was started in Sydney in 1958. Right. They're still going at Miranda. So,
right.
But were you surprised at how quickly the game took on in Sydney and in Queensland?
Right. Well, I'm deeply parochial about this. I'm not all that happy with it. But I know it's unstoppable. But I prefer it to be a nice, cosy Melbourne thing, where Melbourne Football Club are winning almost invariably, beating your lot.
That's right. Yeah.
But here, Barry, your position's the same as your old nemesis Bob Santa Maria, because he never wanted the game to go national either.
No, I'd rather not be linked with my nemesis.
But Ross, tell us about Bob's in the second edition, but he's not in the first edition. So what happened there?
Right. Well, yes, what happened was... the first edition's called The Greatest Game, and we wanted Bob Santamaria, and as Gerard noted, I did the last long TV interview with him before he died, Santamaria, and we're trying to get up a TV doco called Stories from the Split.
What was the question?
It doesn't matter, right?
It doesn't matter.
Why is he in the second edition, not in the first?
Oh, because my publisher's editor refused, and the publisher refused to go ahead with the book if Santa Maria was in it. How about that?
Yeah.
So we thought it was very important to put him in.
Yeah.
There are two things that puzzle me about Aussie rules football. One is, because you talk about a national game, but it's not. What puzzles me is, why isn't there a team from Tasmania?
Right.
And the second thing that always puzzles me is, why isn't there a send-off rule in Aussie rules? Because some of you will remember the Hawthorn star coach...
Brereton.
He coached Brisbane as well.
Right.
Lee Matthews. Lee Matthews broke... Brunz's jaw in a game against Geelong.
He was arrested
as soon as he stepped out of the, and he was prosecuted, but then he won it on appeal. But the truth is, if I'm a player playing my last game and I have no wish to play in a junior league, I can do whatever I want. So just... If anybody can answer, why is it that Aussie rules doesn't have a send-off rule?
Right.
So okay. I'm happy about the extent to which the thing has spread interstate, because I moved to Sydney and was able to go to football and watch football, and I moved to Queensland. I was able to go to football and watch football. So for a perfectly selfish reason, I'm very happy with that. But that's great. But I agree about Tasmania. I think something has to be done about
it. No, it's quite
that.
Simple. Melbourne took Tasmanian players, you know.
Yes, yes.
The best ones were taken by...
Well, now there should be a Melbourne-Tasmania merger.
Yes.
A merger.
Who are you barracking for now? You're still barracking for Essendon?
No, that's not a bad idea for the Melbourne Football Club and a Tasmanian club to merge.
Across the ditch.
They did have a send-off rule in the amateur code.
Yeah.
But I think they gave it up because some guys were using it to get the first shower, I think.
Right.
Hot water.
Barry, the Tasmanian issue. Right. Ray Groom was your enforcer, as I recall.
That's right. Yes. And he went into politics.
Indeed.
He was enforcing. Yes.
And that's having been his colleague in politics.
Oh, yeah.
I wanted to ask you,
right,
is being an enforcer an indication of the sort of skills one would expect former Australian rules players to express as politicians? And would you describe former Australian rules players as politicians as successful or otherwise?
Well, he's the only one I can think of, but every team had an enforcer, and I actually didn't know that he was. I mean, in those days, I think he might have been Jack Mueller, I don't know. But no, I don't think it's an inflexible principle. When they leave football, they become... help me.
There have been a few in Victoria.
Yeah, right, they have been enforcers. Yeah. No,
Dixon.
No, Jeff Dixon. But he wasn't an enforcer. Right. He was a quiet winger.
And a more recent one.
Was he successful?
Yes, he was. Yes, he was a good politician, a good winger.
Born up in the politics in Tasmania.
Okay, now I think we're losing control of this.
Yeah. I'm
a migrant to this country, so I don't know a lot of the early history.
Yes.
But could you tell us something about, I've forgotten the name now, the chap who called Sydney.
Barry, my name's Barry.
No, when they won the first premiership.
Paul Roos.
Before Paul Roos, we won it under...
Melbourne always won premierships in the early 50s. It was always a Melbourne football team.
Okay, but about Paul Roos then, who coached...
Sydney.
And Ron Barassi, who was... very instrumentally bringing the game over here, I think.
The thing about Barassi...
Ron was a traitor. Come on,
I was just going to say, that's right.
I think we should hear Barry on Barassi, right, because Barassi left Melbourne in 1964 to go to Carlton. Right?
He betrayed. This was a big, great betrayal. This was the first time that one player left another, I think, for commercial reasons. This is when money started to bite into the whole thing in a much more severe way than had been the case before. And I think gradually it's become... more and more commercially oriented, as I think is fairly obvious. But we could never get over, we Melbourne supporters, the betrayal of Barassi.
Well, you haven't won a premiership since.
No, it's only a rubber engine.
Melbourne's last premiership was 1964.
And that was absolutely devastating for Melbourne supporters.
It was, yes.
And as was the Fitzroy Football Club merging with the Brisbane Bears.
Right, that's
stupidly named.
Right. Barry Dickens wrote a wonderful play called
Roy Boys, which is in the book.
I know it's in the book, yes, and about the fact that Fitzroy went to...
So it's a rich and complex history.
Right, that is.
Yes.
As I'm standing here listening, I'm a Melbourne person from a long way back. It really has, the game really has changed. I mean, we have grandsons that go to the little, the junior Australian rules. And the organisation of Aussie rules football beyond the old Melbourne style is amazing. It leaves soccer for dead up here. But listening to you with the stories, what can be done to bring back some of that? I mean, you've written the book, but shouldn't there be more in the way of television and information about the culture of Aussie rules? Because It isn't what we're seeing on the television.
It's not a culture.
It's completely commercialised now.
It's not a word that is kind of.
What can be done?
It's not a word that links easily with Australian football. The word culture. I think someone would reach for their revolver when.
We need another play like the club.
It'll never change back to what it was, but in the days when I followed, it's followed the gradual disorganisation of society. I mean, my kids say, please don't start another phrase or sentence within the old days, but I will. In the old days, players kept to their positions, you know, there was a full back, a full forward. They generally didn't stray, but now, to me, packs of caribou run up and down, no one keeps in their bloody position. So that's not an answer.
Although it's probably true that Australian rules footballer are far more intelligent than rugby players.
Easy.
Who have no neck.
Yes, they have an enormous neck.
Ross, I think you're talking about rugby league. There is a difference. You know.
Is there?
Yeah. Wondering about the origin of Australian rules. Some people say it was originally an Aboriginal game, some people an Irish game.
Yeah. Mm. I suspect that might be a myth. I'm not sure, but I have a son who is very interested in that, in the fact that Tom Wills, one of the founders, in his sheep station in the Western District, often played some kind of football with the Aboriginal people there. But I don't know whether it's something that we'd like to think was the case.
And of course, his family got massacred at Collingaringo.
They did, that's right.
Almost all of the Wills family were destroyed.
That's right. There's a very good novel about that called The Fall by Martin Flanagan. Mm. And he became a drunkard and he stabbed himself with scissors. Yes, he did. Very sad man. But he pioneered the game.
Would you keep moving a little bit closer? You're moving away from. I want you closer to the microphone.
Let's see.
Hit it this way. Yeah.
Stuart.
All three of you started in Melbourne and you're now in Sydney. Do you feel that Melbourne is more tribal than Sydney is? And if that's the case, why is that the case?
Well, I'll have a go at that first. I think Melbourne used to be like that. I think now, when I go to Melbourne now, I cannot believe how different it is from the Melbourne I grew up in. So I can't really say whether it's tribal. Now, certainly, in the kind of way we're talking about football then, it was tribal. But I don't think that's the case now. I think it's much more spread out and not so. What
that's
do you
absolutely
think
right.
That?
And all of the tribal grounds, like Victoria Park,
right,
the Collingwood,
they're gone now.
They're all
they?
Gone.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
They're in that dreadful Etihad Stadium
that's
or
right.
all yeah. play at the MCG.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, but Sydney supporters are still fickle.
Yes.
Quite unlike like Collingwood supporters, we stick through thick and thin, mainly thin. But Collingwood,
but you don't go to Victoria. That's gone.
That's gone.
Victoria Park.
Yeah. That's the problem.
Yes.
I mean, one of the problems.
Yes.
But Sydney supporters,
right?
They will go in droves if they're winning.
Right.
But in a rough period, membership drops off, attendances drop off, and that wouldn't happen with Collingwood or Richmond supporters.
Well, it's happening with Melbourne. There are about 10 supporters.
Sure. Well, they should, as the man said, join with Tasmania.
I can't. Oh, no.
I grew up in Yarraville, in West Melbourne, and the street divided between people who supported Footscray or who supported Essendon. That was the way of it, very tribal in that sense. Quite why it divided along the street like that, I don't know. But and I supported Essendon and with my sister. And when I was writing the piece that appears in this book, harking back to the book, I asked her, does she remember why we supported Essendon rather than Footscray? And she said, for the most base of reasons. Essendon was winning and Footscray wasn't. but I did have an uncle who played for Essendon seconds, and that was a kind of solidifying thing. So it was very much that connection. That connection.
Your uncle and Ross's father.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, they must have played in the seconds together.
They could have.
Talk about closeness of it all. Well, there's someone down there, I think.
Yes, I just have a question. Barry, as entertaining as the stories about Melbourne and Richmond were, I think the first game of football was between Geelong and Melbourne in 1858.
It was, yes, that's right.
And I'd also add that Tom Wills was the president of Geelong. And I'd also add that Geelong is still the only club with its own home ground.
That's true.
What a remarkable success story.
Yeah. Right, right.
Geelong supporters.
Yes. But Tom Wills was president of the Melbourne club before he did the Geelong. There's much dispute about this.
Yes.
Melbourne likes to call itself the oldest football club in the world, in fact, because the rugby, various organisations in Sydney and the private school in London hadn't really organised yet. I don't know whether that's factually true, but we like to, never mind about factual truth. We like our beliefs. Melbourne's the oldest club and the bloody worst club
at the moment.
And never let the facts get in the way.
No, that's
story.
Right, of course not.
Just on a point of detail, he was associated with the Melbourne Football Club and he started the game to keep the Melbourne cricketers fit.
That's right, yes. That's right, he did, yeah. And he became...
Well, he coached a team of Aborigines.
He did, he took them to England.
No, he didn't take them.
He didn't?
Someone else, he got bumped out and sidelined because he was drunk and someone else took them to England.
Yeah, that's right.
And then, as Barry said, shortly after he killed himself,
stabbed him. Yes, with a scissors.
With a pair of scissors.
A pretty hard thing to do.
Yeah, difficult thing to do.
If Jack Dyer was listening to all this, what do you think he would say?
I wouldn't like to play against him in the pocket, that's all I can say. No, I don't know what he'd say. No, probably nothing.
Can I ask you about the gentrification, at least, of names.
Right.
I mean, Footerscray was bloody Footerscray.
Right.
Now it's Western Bulldogs.
Right.
Is this gentrification also evidenced by the changing in the name of the John Elliott stand?
Well, I think it's commercialisation, you know. That's, well, it's the Bulldogs, isn't it? Not Footscray.
It's the Western Bulldogs.
Yes, that's right. So the tribal thing is gradually disappearing with these new... But I think that's popularisation, commercialisation, rather than gentrification. What do you think about that? Mm.
Yeah. But you haven't mentioned John Elliott at all tonight, just for interest.
We'd rather not.
There's a question right down the back.
There seems to be a bit of a hold-up in Australian rules being introduced as an Olympic sport. What's stopping this?
Suggestion Australian rules should be introduced.
Yes, it'd be good because Australia would always win it. Like, why not? We should do that.
There's a question around the corner there,
with the... those fantastic, iconic characters that you've talked about, the Dyers and that. Do you think that these days there is that colour in the personalities of people playing the game? Or do you think it's maybe a generational thing that we older supporters identify with those characters in the past? Or do you think in 30 years' time the people playing now will be iconic characters of that era?
Well, Chris, one of the reasons why there aren't those sort of iconic enforcers like Captain Blood is that the rules are so tough now on contact. Mm. So it would be impossible for Jack Dyer to play football anymore.
Yeah.
And the sort of calling out for more blood on the field, which mainly comes from rugby league supporters, I have to say.
Yeah.
Bring back the biff.
Yeah, bring back the biff.
Right.
Well, that can't happen in Australian rules anymore.
Right. The other thing is, I doubt whether even those icons, certainly Jack Dyer, he wouldn't get a game these days.
No, that's true.
I think it was too slow. Coleman, of course, would. But Jack was never fast. His greatest achievement was inventing the drop punt, which we won't demonstrate right now. We could do it.
Do a drop kick.
Yep.
Well, I think that is important, though, because the drop punt then became the kick that really changed the nature of the game.
It did.
So Dyer was one of the earlier ones, wasn't he?
He was.
Did you ever see him kick a drop punt?
No, he didn't. No. Not that I saw. I saw him knock a few players over.
Although I remember the very first time my dad and I used to listen to the football on the radio, and the very first time I heard Jack Dyer speak, he said about a Collingwood wingman,
They say you're a star, son. I don't think you'll be shining today.
That's a good sentence for Jack.
Okay, we're getting near the end, near the siren. So yeah.
I was in the army for 7 years, and I will say this about Aussie rules as compared to two other major sports, rugby and soccer. It's simple, and you don't have to know the rules, and you can get in there and you can play it. And I think it's got great potential worldwide
right.
to do that because of the simplicity of the game.
Well, the only problem with that is it's not simple. It's quite... Yeah, the game, the rules have become quite complex.
That's right.
So I don't know whether that would apply or not. I know a number of rugby people who have tried to master Australian football, and all the best they can do is aerial ping pong, which is a perpetual pathetic comment. But I think it's a fairly complex. The rules are now quite complex, aren't they?
They are indeed. Yeah. And it's very hard for people from other codes
yes.
to move into Aussie rules.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Mm.
Because of all of the rules.
Yes, yes.
Did anyone ever get the better of Mr. Dyer?
Not in the physical sense. But he was never a skillful, brilliant player. He was just an enforcer. And he was feared by...
So no enforcer took the enforcer out?
I don't think so. Little boy, the only one that could match him was Norm Johnson. Do you right. remember Norm Johnson
from
Fitzroy?
Melbourne?
No.
No, from Fitzroy.
Fitzroy.
Fitzroy. No, I don't know.
No, I don't think anyone did. No.
Okay, so...
Only death defeated him at the end.
But I want everybody to know that Gerard Henderson is an Essendon tragic, and if you could spread that around, I'd be great.
The only problem with that is he pronounced it Essendon with the N. The correct pronunciation avoids the N. Essendon. Get it, Essendon.
Someone should tell Barry Cassidy this and bowl it up to him on the insiders.
Yeah. Right.
Well, the truth is I am in a state of constant grief because I still haven't got over... John Coleman suspension on the eve of the 1951 or Essendon's defeat to Carlton in 1968
right.
when Noonan clearly had a free kick in front of the goal and he was pushed out by Wes Lofts.
Yes,
I haven't got over that either.
Wes Lofts was a dirty player. He was a dirty player.
These things matter. When Bob Santamaria got home one day after Carlton lost the grand final, he was met at the front door by his wife, who had no interest in the game, and Helen Santamaria said to Bob, "Don't worry, Bob, it's only a game."
Right.
He never got over that.
Very good.
So I think we're pretty well there, folks.
You were.
Can I just say thanks to Peter and to Ross and to Barry for a very entertaining night and remind you their copies. I'm sure they would all be happy to sign the book. Wonderful Christmas present. You can read all these people, all these tragics talking about this game they never play.
although Morris Lurie talks about the man who hated football.
Oh, well, I see, yes.
Yeah. And Bob Watson kicked 17 goals for his country football team once.
Who did?
He's Don Watson.
Right.
He's Turner there.
Was the other side on the ground? I mean, or were they at the pub? This is the point. Don't believe any of the folks. Don't believe any of the stories in here. But otherwise, bye. So can I just say thanks to Peter Corris, to Barry Oakley, and to Ross Fitzgerald for an entertaining night. Thank you, folks.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.